Hello and welcome to the 21CB thing, your podcast for Buddhism in the 21st century with Singarava, Tarapalata and myself,
hello.
As always, on a Sunday, sunny Monday morning, as always. Mm-hmm. I think...
Great to see you again.
Great to see you. It's been a long time. Mm-hmm. And I think I'll just plunge right in with a story. I've brought a story for
very
you.
Good.
Mm. It's... I don't think there's that much, well, there's some sort of Buddhist teaching in it, but I encountered, it's a story about one of the followers of the Buddhas, and it kind of, in a very short song, describes his journey from an outcast or like lower caste member to his journey to enlightenment. So it's a bit longer, but I think it's, it reads quite nicely and it's quite... It goes in well, so I'm just going to read it to you. It's part just for you to know. It's part of the so-called Theragata, so the songs of the senior monks, and he is called Sunita. I don't know what that means. Okay. I was born in a low-class family. We were poor with little to eat. My job was lowly. I threw out the old flowers. Shunned by people, I was disregarded and held in contempt. I humbled my heart and paid respects to many people. Then I saw the Buddha at the fore of the mendicant Sangha. The great hero was entering the capital city of Magadha. I dropped my flail and approached to pay homage. Out of compassion for me, the supreme man stood still. When I had paid homage at the teacher's feet, I stood to one side and asked the Supreme Being for the going forth. Then the teacher, being sympathetic and having compassion for the whole world, said to me, "Come, monk." That was my ordination. Staying alone in the wilderness, meditating tirelessly, I have completed what the teacher taught, just as the victor advised me. In the first watch of the night, I recollected my past lives. In the middle watch of the night, I purified my clairvoyance. In the last watch of the night, I shattered the mass of darkness. At the end of the night, as the sunrise drew near, Indra and Brahma came and revered me with joined hands. Homage to you, O thoroughbred. Homage to you, supreme among men. Since your defilements are ended, you, sir, are worthy of a religious donation. When he saw me honored by the assembly of gods, the teacher smiled and said the following, "By austerity and spiritual practice, by restraint and by taming, that's how to become a Brahmin. This is the supreme Brahmin."
Very
good.
Need a few moments to take it in.
I just need to take my jacket off. I'm going to make a lot of noise.
it's getting
hot here.
I know, I turned the heat on.
Turn it off. Yeah, just, it's interesting to, I think the whole point of it is sort of, I mean, the background is obviously an Indian one with the caste system. So he came from a very lower caste. Well, meaning that he couldn't, you know, out of, you know, traditional Indian view, he couldn't change much about his life. He was kind of predestined to, I don't know, through probably what it means. He was, his job was to clear out old flowers from, I don't know, maybe temples or whatever somewhere.
The markets. Or
the markets, probably not temples. He wouldn't be allowed in them, but just to sort of throw away, you know, things that have already faded, that have lost their beauty. And then he says, you know, I humbled my heart and paid respects to many people. And then the sort of the last person he's paying respect to is the Buddha. But then obviously through his practice, he becomes someone who's actually being revered
by the
gods.
Brahmas.
Well, Indra and Brahma, which are the highest gods of Hindu thought, thought to be the highest.
Wow. Yeah. It's quite a radical journey then, isn't it? Even mythologically speaking.
Yeah.
Especially, I'm not a great expert on Indian culture, but to go from what sounds like the whole gradated caste system, to go from the kind of bottom to beyond the top.
Yeah.
Why did you?
I don't know. Interested. I was looking at those verses because it's a collection from the Pali Canon. So. I don't know. I just realized I've never really looked into those songs by the elder monks. Mm. So those are all. It's a collection of songs of monks who've already gained enlightenment. Mm. So they talk about their journey to enlightenment. And there's a version. There's the Terigata for the nuns. Yeah. And
you say songs. Does that mean that would be sung? That would have been
I think it just means it's in verse. It's kind of it's written in a verse.
And I think there was the tradition that they kind of. After they gained enlightenment, they would kind of present their enlightenment experience in a verse form or in a song. So, which I think you find also in the Tibetan culture with the Bhadra songs and all that. So that's
Exactly. I think that's what it reminded me of Milarepa, and just sort of thinking, oh, actually, there's so much in the Pali Canon that we find in later tradition as well. It's kind of all in there in the earliest scriptures and.
Their inspiration was just like, probably a more appropriate way of kind of conveying their inspiration.
And just something that spoke to me in these verses of Sunita is kind of, I don't know, throughout it just seems like he's keeping his humility kind of. I just have this image of Sunita now. Who's, he comes from a very low caste environment, but he doesn't get arrogant about it. And, when he encounters the Buddha and says, oh, I need to then overthrow the system, or I don't know, I need to get angry about it. But he says, okay, well, I just sort of raise up myself, but still being quite humble.
Yeah, I mean, it also reminded me of some of the texts where I think the Buddha in different suttas, he kind of compared people who were kind of sticking to rules or like kind of doing ritual baths and cleanings and then always saying, because I think that was quite popular in that time, that people thought they needed to go and wash away their sins and purify themselves through going into the Ganges and then he was always saying, no, you're becoming a true Brahmin by kind of purifying your mind and not by just going into the water. So, and I think that's the same kind of pattern that he uses to say, okay, you're becoming the true Brahma is through your kind of purification of your heart. And it's not by just being part of a specific caste or obeying superficial rules.
I mean, the Brahmin obviously being the highest caste, there is almost sort of they believe that they've been born out of the mouth of
Brahma.
Is it Brahma or is it Indra? Is a Hindu god definitely in there? But they are almost from Brahma's descendants. So there's some sort of demigod kind of god on earth. So that's what was believed. But I think, I mean, obviously here in the West we don't have the caste system, but I think it opens up the question about conditionality, like what we are born with. And I don't know, too easily we say, well, this is just what we're born with. I mean, obviously from just looking at the caste system, one could say, oh yeah, it's a social construct, but we could just say, well, kind of almost the same as if you're saying, well, I'm just that kind of person that can't change. But actually, I think the caste, if you take the caste system as a sort of metaphor for just conditionality in general, I don't know, the character we bring into our lives, the character we developed, our skills, what we're not skilled in, and sort of thinking, oh, well, I can't. I think it's quite inspiring to think, well, you can actually lift yourself out, up and lift yourself out of, your situation in general.
Yeah, and I'm also thinking about the kind of the fetter of just sticking to certain rituals and tradition, and just kind of because we've been raised with a certain idea of what religion is, mm-hmm. and kind of, and as long as we don't kind of get out of that and really practice, we're kind of trapped in a certain way, like or you could easily think you're a good Buddhist because you perform puja or you do certain things, but that is not at the heart of Buddhism, or that will not kind of lead you to enlightenment or to being a like a true practitioner in a sense. And I think there's a danger as well, like just ticking boxes or
I was going to say, I think that we're in the same position in a way, because you can do, I think most Buddhists that have been practicing sometimes for decades, you can end up completely without knowing it, just doing what you're supposed to do. But it's like you're not quite practicing. It's weird. You can meditate every day in the morning, do all the rituals, do all the meetings you're supposed to do all the things. And somehow you're not really there, or it's not really happening. And then you realize that, and then you I don't quite know what happens, but there has to be a kind of, I don't know, sometimes you've got to throw the apple cart over, or whatever the expression is, and see what's actually going on. And find that thread, the actual golden thread, isn't it? It's not reliant on just performing the actions.
Yeah, and I think you need to involve your heart and your mind. I was just reminded of a verse I read this morning where Shantideva was saying that you can perform acts with your body and your speech, ritual acts, over a long, long time, but as long as your mind is somewhere else, it's in vain somehow. Yeah. It's not going to lead you.
But I mean, even if your mind is there somehow, you know, you can sort of do it in a way where your mind is there, but you're not quite, I don't know, you're so close. You're kind of mentally, you're there practicing, and somehow you haven't quite tapped into the spirit of it. It's like there's a little leap or a little under or over that hasn't quite, you haven't quite got in there. I don't know who it was. I'd missed. I didn't listen to Padma Vajra's talk on the weekend, but somebody, I think Padmasagar was saying it, he was saying something about Buddhism in a way is about refinding the path. Was it him? Like, you know, you've got to find that path every day. You have to find the path. Maybe it's not that talk, but I thought it was quite interesting. It's like that's kind of the goal, your mission in a way. You don't just find the path once. It's like almost every moment. You just like, how do I actually practice now? Or what does it actually mean? Where am I for a start?
It's a constant corrective, isn't it?
Where am I? How do I engage with this more fully somehow?
Yeah, I think there's this quite nice quote where it says, it's not about following the steps of those wise who have gone before you, that won't lead you to enlightenment, but you have to kind of look for the questions that they have sought after instead of just following what they did. Because in a way, probably everyone has to kind of find the path for him or herself again and again by just asking the right questions and not just following outer kind of things that for somebody worked, but probably might not work for yourself.
I mean, maybe it all relates to being on autopilot. Because in a way, that is the enemy of the whole spiritual life, isn't it? Where you can call yourself a Buddhist and be a Buddhist and even get ordained, and you just kind of go on autopilot, and you can do that for a decade and 2 decades and whatever. And it's like, how do you get out of that? Like on a moment-to-moment basis, how do you get off autopilot? And it's really, probably, I think it's a lot more demanding or a lot more intensive than one thinks somehow.
You know, what I find interesting in this story is that, first of all, what also struck me was the Buddha himself, because he was, it's interesting because he, in a way, Sunita doesn't tell us why he wants to get ordained. He just says, well, he was poor, he had little to eat, job was lowly, I was disregarded and held in contempt, paid respects to many people, saw the Buddha, approached to pay homage, and then he just said, out of compassion for me, the supreme man stood still. So that was probably the first time in his life that someone out of compassion stood still in front of him. So that must have been a great, well, must have left an impression on him.
Quite a shock, maybe.
Quite a shock, even. So that, and then just the next verse is already, when I had paid homage at the teacher's feet, I stood to one side and asked the Supreme Being for the going forth. So immediately asks for ordination just from, okay, so the Buddha is just out of compassion. He stands still in front of that lowly person in front of him, so that the person immediately feels, Sunita immediately feels, well, seen, feels acknowledged, inspired. By the presence. So I think there's something about, well, kind of guidance or friendship, or, you know, so sort of that, you know, we always talk about kind of working on ourselves, working on our mind, but I think we sometimes forget about the fact that we need a lot of guidance and a lot of friendship and a lot of receptivity, because it needs a lot of receptivity to be able to, well, be so inspired by someone just sitting, just acknowledging you and just looking at you with full of compassion.
But I think it's also about the inspiration, because is probably the key to going off, leaving autopilot. Mm-hmm. If you can just get in touch with your own inspiration and what you really feel moves you or like kind of shakes, shakes you and wakes you up. I think then that's probably somewhere. That's the right direction, probably, and that's also not just being in the mind, but being moved emotionally somehow, so there's mind and heart at the same time.
You probably need to have that openness to exit autopilot, to be like, well, sometimes you are on that autopilot, but then you need to, sometimes you just, there will be moments when you have an inkling of an inspiration, something happens to you. It might be just all of a sudden you listen to a bird and you're like, oh, wow, that's really beautiful. Like it's some moment of beauty or something. And you're like, oh, what am I doing with my life? I mean, it'll be quite tricky to meet the Buddha these days, but just something that points towards something higher might arise, just an ordinary life, and that might bring you out of it.
Yeah, but I think it's really, the trick is really to kind of pay attention to those moments and not just kind of... to really take them seriously.
There was I can't remember exactly the story, but I think Padmavaja was saying when Bhante was in India, he was in the slums doing these, doing loads of talks. And there was one, I think this one guy like pushed to the front, and he was like a local, I mean, like a gangster in a way, like a local thug. He just pushed everyone out of the way and like went to the front with his crew. Right. And I think Bhante said something like, oh, I'm glad you could make it or something, and sit down. And the guy was so shocked that someone had treated him with kindness and actually acknowledged him in a positive sense that he stopped his gangsterism and became an order member.
Oh, wow.
I thought it was really something.
Yeah.
You know, like some kind of scary character. It made me think, I saw sort of Bhante in a different light in a way. It's just sort of fearless and sort of like, oh, just a genuine... Well, you've got to be quite something to be able to take that on board and acknowledge somebody like that and just say, oh, I'm good, glad you're here, you know, rather than, oh, God, should I call the police or, you know.
It's a bit like the story of Angulimala, the murderer, and the Buddha not being afraid, which I always thought, it's a puzzle somehow that he's not running away, somehow that he can face all that evilness and all the fear with compassion somehow. And that also kind of converted Angulimala, probably also because he was completely shocked.
There's got to be an instinct, hasn't there, then for the person that you're talking to? Because some people, well, I don't know, they seem a bit far gone, but other people maybe on the surface, you know, you might look at them and think, oh dear, they're a bit off key, but actually maybe there's something in them that's really looking for something. And to be able to see that and recognize that's quite a skill, isn't it, to just move away from one's kind of social, I don't know, you know, the social signifiers that you're in danger or somebody's a threat or a problem or just not really worth it, and then you know that instinct to see what's actually going on with them maybe.
It really takes a lot of courage, I think, to kind of not, to really kind of act on the basis of compassion in a way.
Well, just to be a sort of a symbol of compassion almost, like, sometimes maybe we misunderstand it as, oh, you need to actively kind of, I don't know, do something out of compassion for that, like, I don't know, the gangster or something, and then you need to kind of do, like, be super kind to him, but maybe just sort of almost embody compassion so that probably don't need to do anything, but just kind of you being yourself on the back of loads of meditation and meeting people and sort of, just living the Dharma life. Will already make you a sort of a symbol for something else. You start to embody more and more the ideal or something transcendental.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the Buddha was really just about himself, but probably it's really the kind of highest top to kind of, I mean, to be able to kind of be just yourself in the front of somebody who's kind of seen as a threat.
Now he's being his non-self, wasn't he? But it's funny, that whole thing, isn't it? Because in a way, it's like Maitreya Bandhu says, isn't he? He's like saying, well, all he's trying to do is just invite, if people want to join, invite them into to live a life together in a way. Which is doesn't sound like much, but it's enormous, especially in the context of something transcendental in the middle, you know, like, well, the Buddhism, but you're just it's an invitation. That's enormous.
Yeah, I like those descriptions also of the ordination, like the Buddha just said, okay, come.
Oh, yeah.
And
he said, then the teacher, being sympathetic and having compassion for the whole world, said to me, come, monk. That was my ordination. Well, it's ihi bhikkhu in Pali, and that was, I think I read it somewhere that, you know, at first it was just ihi bhikkhu, come with me, follow me, monk, or bhikkhuni, nun, which was, that's, he just said, well, follow me. And then that was ordination. The ordination. Yeah. But it's interesting that he said that the teacher, being sympathetic and having compassion for the whole world, saying, so he didn't only have compassion for him, but something about the ordination being rooted in his compassion for the whole world is, I don't know, something in there is quite, it's not just individualistic, it's kind of, well, because the world needs people who are going for refuge.
And I think also because with creating that sangha and creating that community, somehow that was what kind of would survive the Buddha's Parinirvana. I mean, we just read the Mahaparinibbana Sutta on the retreat the week before. And I think that was really nice because it ended with this Ananda kind of pleading, asking the Buddha, stay and don't go away, out of compassion for the world. And then the Buddha answers that he said, okay, no, but I've taught the Dharma out of compassion for the world, and I've decided not to leave the world until there's a community that can has well understood the Dharma and that can teach it, and the Dharma is well spread for out of compassion for the world. Yeah. So I think, so probably he saw creating that sangha, creating that community as an act of compassion in order to ensure that the Dharma would kind of continue and stay in the world.
Yeah, it needs context, doesn't it? It needs a sort of, we're so kind of, we think, well, you know, a teaching needs to be either one-to-one or, I don't know, through books, through words, that's how we learn things. But actually it's, well, yeah, I mean, there's great benefit in that, but also it needs, well, just the lived out culture of something where you can actually learn something. So I think, just as you said, like, you know, Maitreya Bandhu, or, I mean, we have other examples of communities here where people just decide to live together. And that, for some reason, is a much, much bigger teaching on, well, how do you actually live out a life of the Dharma? You can learn all about it in books and in talks, but...
I think in a way we're trying to do something fairly, well, not fairly, very unusual.
Yeah.
Especially the Tree Ratners, but, you know, I couldn't really speak on other Buddhist movements, I wouldn't want to say, but... like you said, you know, creating a context, it's not just a one-to-one. You don't just get one-to-one teachers that are kind of set up as special, I don't know, as teachers in their own, by themselves, and they've got a small group around them, and then they've got their own podcasts or books, or, you know, it's like there's a whole, I think the vision is different. It's like establishing a culture across countries and what, and it's quite, you know, it's quite unusual. And if you maybe when one first comes along, it's not immediately apparent either, but it's a huge kind of goal in a way, isn't it, to kind of establish the Dharma culturally across countries, even in the modern world. It's not just an individualistic, I don't know about salvation is the wrong word, but it's not just an, it's like a, you're trying to generate a culture where people can emerge from, really, aren't you? Which is, it's not that common.
Yeah, and I think it's so much easier to kind of understand certain things if you just observe people interacting, because I guess a lot of what the Buddha taught is just much easier to understand if you can kind of see people acting with generosity or kindness towards each other.
Yeah.
And it's not just a theoretical thing, because, and that's also where I think we have certain preconceptions of what religion is, or from the Christian background or society, that might stand in the way of kind of really understanding what the Buddha taught. And so, I don't know, I mean, I think like some of the schools that really focus on a teacher, and I think I'm not really sure how well they work in our society, in our context, where we have certain I don't know, certain strange ideas about what religion is. I don't know, I mean, I have not much experience with other groups, but that was something where I thought, no, I mean, it's not, I mean, I can see myself that what I grew up were kind of strange ideas about what religion is.
Can you name a few?
I'm just thinking, and I might.
Well, it's just, I mean, as you say, it's kind of an atmosphere almost. You can't put a finger on, like, oh, this is, but just when people, you see that with people coming into the Buddhist center here, for example, it's just, well, they sometimes behave as if either they're coming to a yoga studio, because that's what they're used to, or they're behaving as if they're coming into a sort of church. And we're not really either of those. We're trying to create a completely different culture and atmosphere. But it's something, how people, how you hold yourself and how you relate to yourself.
Yeah, I don't know. It's something that I probably sometimes don't really find authentic in a way, the way people relate to being, if they want to kind of be revere something or show reverence. I think this, in some, the way I grew up with, I mean, which there wasn't much reverence shown, but when it was shown, it never felt authentic, like coming really from the hearts of people. It was somehow an idea of how reverence, I don't know, something really, really weird. And
was
I think
it formalized or ritualistic?
Yeah,
or,
ritualistic, formalized, but also a bit, I mean, there was a really strange atmosphere around that. And so I think like really, it's just something different if you really feel like, oh, I want to revere the Buddha for what he kind of taught and for what he kind of found. And it's, and I really want to kind of transform myself. And this is just a, I feel like it's, and religion is just a way not to be somehow a good person or whatever, but to kind of transform and to let, to overcome your ego and to kind of, to live a true, a truly, a really truly worthy life. So, and I don't know, I mean, I, that was not my conception of religion in a way. And I guess all, like, there's a certain overlap that all religion in their essence trying to create a system that helps you kind of develop as an individual somehow to some level. But I mean, I never thought in that, in those
kind of categories. Yeah, it's almost as if we have to well, first of all, I mean, we talked about that a few times now on this podcast, but, you know, reinvent Buddhism almost. Well, Buddhism the form, but not the Dharma, obviously, here in the West. But as you were saying, you kind of have to do that with yourself as well, because you kind of, your views keep coming in, when your likes and your dislikes. I find that kind of project that we're engaged with quite interesting to sort of to think about, okay, how do we create an authentic Buddhism here in the West, and how do I become an authentic Buddhist as well? Sometimes, well, obviously, you know, traditional Buddhism has developed all these rules and sets of and forms, ordained people look like that, and you know, not ordained people look like that, and this is what a shrine room is supposed to look like. But we've talked about that a few times, but still, that's an interesting. It's just an interesting path in a way.
It's funny because I was thinking it's easier. Well, it's not easier to do than to talk about, but in a way it is, because it's like you have to have your finger on the pulse, don't you? Because you are trying to create shared images that work collectively, that you can have like icons and rituals that, they probably take decades, hundreds of years to get established in the psyche. Like, so you do need a kind of collective, continual practice together, and even a shared iconography. And at the same time, you can't just sleep on that and just fall into a rut and just say, oh, okay, this is Buddhism, Namo Buddha, you know, do all the stuff and follow the form. Because in a way, it's quite shocking to realize that you do actually have to you almost have to reinvent your own movement, your own tradition, everywhere you go, and probably every class. Every interaction, it's like you're kind of trying to reinvent or rediscover. It's not always apparent. It's not in the beginning, you know. I think that when I first came along, I just thought, oh, here's a tradition. It's been going for this long, and it's connected to that, and this is what it looks like, and I'll just sort of fit in and try and work
just
with
follow
it.
Follow what they're doing.
Sometimes I'm like, oh, this is horrible. Sometimes I'm like, oh, this is great. And then I thought, oh no, actually, this is really. It's even more. I wouldn't say there's pressure on you, but there's even more impetus to kind of you're in a position of I mean, in a way, we're kind of lucky because it's a really creative time. I mean, sometimes we kind of lack a certain depth, but I'm sure that you probably get that in fossilized traditions where there's a complete superficiality where you've got, it's been going for thousands of years, but everyone's forgotten we've lost the
spirit.
But I think we're in a potentially creative sort of period, aren't we?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that was something I always really liked about Buddhism, and especially Mahayana Buddhism, where you kind of not stick to some kind of scripture, but you know that you kind of constantly need to reinvent or kind of relive the Dharma, and to kind of express the Dharma in the conditions where you are. You kind of constantly need to kind of think, how is it best expressed in those conditions that where we are. And I think that's something that also keeps you alive somehow. And I think I couldn't practice it in a tradition where you just tend on a certain set of very kind of set practices without any kind of creativity to kind of reinvent that.
Yeah, well,
somehow.
Kind of, you're not really in a living tradition then, are you? Because I mean, and it's in a way, it's to do principles, isn't it? You've got rules and principles, and it was good. Lalita Ratna gave a very good talk on the weekend, and this whole thing of like, we don't have 10 commandments, you know, there's no kind of authority that's dishing out rules. There's principles, and if you've got you need to know the principles, don't you? But once you've kind of absorbed them, you can be creative. It's not like you're stuck in a kind of tied up with all these rules. It's more like you've got these creative principles of things that are probably best not to do because they lead this way, and then you know the positive side of that. So it's a different. I think if you've got principles, then you don't have to worry too much about being stuck. Actually,
And it really opens up a possibility to live a creative life, which in essence is the Dharma life. I mean, it is the most creative life that's possibly imaginable. And so I think with all this, that's where I think it really fits very well with a certain longing that we have in our society, or that I used to have, but I couldn't. I mean, I couldn't relate it to religion, that longing. But I think that's really what actually Buddhism is really about. So kind of how to lead a creative life.
And it does start with with your own transformation in a way. I think you can only build up a living tradition if you're willing to, well, question your views all the time, but also to really apply yourself to practice.
And I mean, if you get stuck on the, I've done it myself many, many times. I still do it. You know, when you get stuck on the externals, the external form of something, the way it looks and what you perceive to be going on, why on earth would you trade the rest of your life in for that?
Yeah.
You know, but then if you get a bit under and you realize, you get a sense of what's behind all that, then it's kind of the most creative. Then if you get, it's like you're saying, it's in the positive, isn't it? If you feel like, oh, this is the most creative, even the strangest, most creative thing that I've done, I'll just keep doing this. Rather than, I don't know, it gets put in the negative sometimes, doesn't it? Oh, you give up this, you give up the renunciation, why would you do it unless you're going to get something better? Why would you do it?
Yeah, and I think also for not getting caught up in the externals, it's also good to kind of acknowledge that, of course, we have an ideal and we have the principles, but what is being left out is not the ideal. So I think it's good to kind of also not, in a sense, see that what's around you is just an expression of people's aspirations somehow and what's possible in these certain conditions, but it doesn't mean that this is how it will be forever in a sense. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I really feel like, I could imagine to have a much more devotional kind of setting, or like also have much more, I don't know. I mean, images, much stronger images that probably we don't have now because it's not the right time, and it would kind of, too many people respond to that in a frightened way. But I really hope that over time, the kind of Buddhism One might hopes, evolve yeah, yeah. somehow to incorporate much more visual expressions and devotional images that I think need time to kind of arise in our psyches, or like we need to be mature enough as collective or as a I don't know, but I think it's really nice to kind of see that potential also and not kind of be stuck with, okay, this is how Buddhism is and it's always going to be like that here.
I think probably also not to get put off by external forms as well, because I certainly had it myself within our own tradition, where I've sat there, my head in my hands, you know, just like, oh my God, this is, I'm just cringe, like total. And then I thought, well, this isn't it. This is just one manifestation of it. It's fine. It's gone. Then the next day it's brilliant, you know, but not to kind of get into it and just think, okay, this is Buddha. This is that. And then you sit there like, oh, this is horrible. Then you think, no, well, this isn't it. This is just, we had to go. It kind of went disastrously wrong, at least for me. That's fine. We'll not do that again. and then something new comes through. But it took me a while. In fact, it was through friendship. There was I had a friend of mine. It was in Bristol. I went to this. I was in a kind of, I was a bit cool in those days. And I went to, what was it called? Buddhaland? I don't know. There was this like rave thing that some of the guys had put on, this Buddhist club thing. And I went there with a friend of mine, Caven, and we were standing there in the corner. And I was used to being in like jungle clubs, you know, like these super cool. And I just said to him, this is terrible. This is like the worst place I've ever been, man. It's so uncool. And he said, yeah, but they're having a go, and you never know. It's the beginning of a culture. And maybe in 100 years, this has turned into something completely unrecognizable. Not a club, but it's this. And I thought, oh yeah, right, that's a different way to look at it. Rather than like, this is just totally cringe. It's actually, maybe it's going somewhere. Mm. It's just people's little attempt, you know, we're all trying to make it work. Anyway.
Shall we go to the next?
Yeah, we can move on.
Who's next?
Do you want to?
No.
Shall I go?
Yeah.
Okay. So I brought some verses from the Bodhicharya Avatara again. The Training Handbook for Future Bodhisattvas, written by Shantideva in the 8th century. I brought two a bit provocative verses.
Oh.
So the first one is, happiness is scarce, suffering persists with no effort, but only through suffering is there escape. Therefore, mind be strong. And the second verse is...
What goes on?
The virtue of suffering has no rival, since from the shock it causes, intoxication falls away, and there arises compassion for those in cyclic existence, fear of evil, and a longing for the conqueror.
Jesus. Oh, literally. That's what it sounds like.
So
what's the difference between that and the Holy Jesus?
I mean, that's why I think it's a bit provocative in a sense, because it goes against what we might think. Mm-hmm. But
I can read
the first one again, and then we can. Yeah. So happiness is scarce. Suffering persists with no effort, but only through suffering is there escape. Mm-hmm. Therefore, mind be strong.
Mm. That's good.
Yeah, well, that's kind of true.
In a sense, yeah.
You can't argue with that.
Can't quite argue with that.
And yeah. I think this was one of the first verses from this text that kind of really stuck with me. Mm-hmm. Stuck with me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because somehow, in all those very unpleasant moments, it came to my mind again.
I just thought, oh no.
Happiness is scarce, suffering persists with no effort, but only through suffering is there escape. And I wonder, because I think I've certainly had a few moments in my life where I thought, where I really suffered. And I think actually they were quite, instrumental or very important in a way of kind of shifting. Mm-hmm. And
we probably need to unpack all that, though, don't we? Because...
Yeah.
It's not just suffering for suffering's sake, is it? It's not like there's any virtue in suffering.
No, not in just suffering and not changing, but to kind of experience suffering in a sense of kind of seeing that there is suffering and that life is coming to an end at some point. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess it's more like seeing the truth of suffering.
I mean, there has to be some kind of faith, doesn't there? Or some kind of, you've got your eyes somewhere else as well. It's not because, it's easy just to clarify, isn't it? Like with that suffering, because Buddhism is not saying there's any virtue in suffering of itself. You're not going to get anywhere good just by self-flagellating and beating yourself up and things like that. But it's definitely, I don't know, I've had that same experience where the suffering comes, but in a way, I think that's why when you're having a good day, that kind of, you read stuff like that, you think, but when you are actually squashed into a corner, you do find out what you believe in a way. You find out what your refuge is. And then my experience has been sometimes when I've been squashed, like properly squashed, not just like having a bad day, but just feeling like, oh, this is horrible. If I get desperate, and then it's like the raft, isn't it? You just jump on the raft again. You're clinging on for dear life. But then in a way you get desperate, and then you bring the Buddha to mind, and then if that's what you're going to do, and then I think that it comes through, doesn't it? And you get put into a different space that you weren't in before, that you couldn't even imagine being in, because the pressure wasn't there. So there's some sort of faith. You just think, oh, I'm done. Yeah, I'm cooked. There's nothing I can do here. I've really lost it. It's rubbish. And then you bring the Buddha to mind, and all of a sudden, well, in my experience, anyway, something's kind of calmed down. I've just been like, oh, right, that's what you're saying. And it's almost like a completely different world. It's not, you're not getting all your usual pleasures and happiness and keep buoying yourself up trying to get all the conditions in place to make you happy. It's like, that's not really working anymore at the moment. And you get pushed into a different, almost a different realm. But I mean, all that does depend, I think, on one's, one's level of, engagement, or how much you actually have the Dharma in your consciousness at that point. Because otherwise you can just spiral out downwards.
Yeah. I mean, it just reminded me of the human realm as compared to the God's realm, where you have just pleasure, and where it said, okay, you can't, it's really difficult, like from the God's realm, to kind of get enlightened because somehow it's so pleasant that you probably don't make enough effort or you don't see why. Yeah. So, and only if you have a good combination or like you have both suffering and pleasant experience in the human realm, that those are the conditions that you need in order to kind of develop. And
so is it to do with sensitivity then? Because I think you can live a fairly regular human life and still really be aware of suffering, can't you? Yeah. Like in a positive sense, like you don't actually necessarily have to have acute suffering perhaps in order for suffering to be a motivating factor. You know, you can see it, you can feel it. And do you know what I mean?
Yeah, in a sense, probably, because I think it is also said that in the like realms of the, I don't know, the pretas, the hungry ghosts, where the suffering persists, it's really difficult. Mm. So I guess if you're in a constant state of suffering, it's really difficult to have enough positivity and actually to escape. Mm-hmm. So it's probably really kind of the mixture of positive experience, but also the sensitivity.
Which is probably why you've got, I mean, there's a whole emphasis, isn't there, in our own tradition, in a way of integration and positive emotion. So in order to, probably in order to experience suffering and it to bring for suffering to be the motivating factor, you probably need some kind of level of being together actually and emotionally positive, so that when you do actually suffer properly, it doesn't just crush you. You know, you don't just you don't go spiraling down, you kind of open perhaps.
I was just thinking that, I mean, there's probably different layers of suffering and layers of happiness. So you're saying you can probably be aware of suffering without being kind of, you know, necessarily living in a hungry ghost realm. I think there's just layers of what we call suffering, I suppose, you know, living in a hell realm or being in a sort of mental state that is like that, like hell, like hungry ghost. That probably is there's much more in-depth kind of suffering, existential suffering, whereas... or maybe even more physical suffering even. Whereas I was just thinking, listening to that could actually be quite inspiring or kind of relieving as well to hear. Yeah. Like, oh, happiness is scarce.
Yeah.
Oh, great. I don't need to put pressure on me all the time to be happy all the time. I don't know why, but I think sometimes I do, when I'm not happy, there is this view coming up sometimes thinking, oh, well, I'm supposed to be happy. Or I'm supposed to be in positive mental states. Sometimes I think we are misguided in thinking what a positive mental state is, because a positive mental state in Buddhism could also be one that is aware of suffering.
And it might even be a bit melancholy or sad, there's a kind of awareness there, isn't there?
Yeah, there's awareness. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to feel fulfilled all the time. So I was just thinking, actually, it sounds grim maybe at first sight, but actually it could also just be quite relieving to hear when you feel like, well, you don't have to hunt after happiness all this time. It's just, it's scarce.
Well, the whole teaching of samsara and the wheel, I found it, not to be grim, but I found it a relief. Mm. I was like, oh, right. It's not like I've done something wrong with my life and I don't know what I'm doing and I'm a particularly useless kind of civilian that doesn't get any happiness. You know, it's actually, this world is actually quite difficult and very difficult sometimes. Mm. And just to acknowledge that. Mm. Yeah, it takes the pressure off and then you can do something about that, can't you? Mm. I mean, I think there's quite a lot of studies, aren't there, you know, in terms of the whole Instagram, Facebook culture where people are presenting themselves as being happy and living the dream. It's creating a lot of suffering because it's not really real, and people just we compare ourselves to people that aren't actually who they say claim to be, and it's very difficult. I think when you're not living in a culture that acknowledges the fact that there is suffering, but then it flips as well, doesn't it? Because you get people that acknowledge the suffering, you get the whole thing, and then it all just becomes your whole life is about suffering, and we have to do something about suffering, like in a really kind of angsty sort of way. And it's like, yeah, it's the middle way.
I think it's because I think for me that was also quite those lines were quite what's the word again? Trösten.
Reassuring, maybe?
Reassuring or I know there's a word in English, but I can't recall it now. So, comforting, I comforting. Think is the word. Yeah. Comforting. Yeah. So, yeah, I think because it also says, okay, but there is escape through suffering. And I think this escape is there also when I can kind of stay with the suffering and just sit there and then see that it kind of changes or like my experience might just calm down, or what you've described with bringing the Buddha to mind, or just being aware and trying to kind of sit with it and acknowledge the fact that there is suffering, but then also to see that it's not all of my experience is suffering. So at the same time, there are positive sensations.
It's funny, when you're suffering, you don't want to hear that, do you? It's like, that's why Buddhists can be really annoying, because you're kind of like, you're not having a good time and you think, oh, everything's terrible. And someone says, oh, is that all there is to your experience? And you're like, oh, just leave me alone. Yeah. It's just like, and then you look and it's like, okay, it's not. And I was like, oh, no, I don't want to get out of this. I was sort of sitting here in my suffering and now I've got to move out of it and do some work, because apparently it's not all suffering. But yeah, I think, yeah, it's interesting because it's not just a lump, is it? It's not just a lump mass. You don't just have suffering. You have something's really unpleasant and then you switch off and then it all just becomes a kind of singular monolithic block of suffering. But actually it's not at all, is it? There's I'm really genuinely, sometimes Buddhists are just really annoying because you just want to suffer. And it's like, what's going on? You're like, oh no, there's more. And maybe I can do something. Oh no, I don't want to do something. Ethics
I mean, it's interesting because those verses, they belong to the chapter on patience, on forbearance. Uh-huh. So, I think it's also kind of, okay, yeah, mind be strong. So stay with it and acknowledge the fact that not everything will be pleasant. Mm. And from the perspective of the future bodhisattva, of course, there will be, even if you act and if you practice Buddhism, there will still be things that you can't control and that will be unpleasant, like people not being friendly to you, people insulting you, like in the case of Shantideva, that he kind of, quotes a lot of interesting incidents where monks kind of steal the food of each other or whatever. Yeah, yeah. So, also even like kind of being patient with the conditions that we have right now and the kind of, if you have a longing for something different, just to acknowledge the fact that it needs time to kind of change or to come into being. And and that might also be suffering, and it's not in the sense of, I don't know, psychological suffering, but it might just be an unpleasant experience if you kind of have a wish or longing for things to be in a different way, even in a positively spiritual way. But
it's funny though, isn't it? Because when your practice is going well, you just think, I'm overcoming. You somehow think you're overcoming samsara, you're getting enlightened just by having lots of pleasant experiences. You like having pleasant experience in meditation and you're generally sort of happy, and you think, it's gonna be like this now, I'm on the path. But in a way, by doing that, you're introducing, someone was talking about, what is it? I don't know. Anyway, you're kind of waking Mara up. At a certain point, you'll be doing something to yourself with all your positive activity that would inevitably lead you to some sort of suffering and crisis, which is the point somehow to get. It's not the point to suffer. I'm just saying exactly what I wasn't saying in the beginning now. Anyway, you know what I mean.
Probably crisis is in a way, or crises are unavoidable if you want to change, because, to let images of yourself or restricted versions of yourself go, will always require a certain moment of crisis somehow. So it's probably a wrong view to kind of think that the Dharma life is very pleasant. I mean, it is much more pleasant in a sense than normal worldly life. It should be pleasant.
Not always.
Yeah,
it should be joyful.
I think that, but I also feel like that the level of joy and gratitude and all that also depends on the level of suffering that we kind of acknowledge.
For sure.
Like there's a depth of emotions that where I felt like, okay, if I can acknowledge suffering in my own experience, I'm also much more able to kind of be much to kind of be more grateful or more positive in like somehow this seems to be related in a sense.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because in a way, I think the whole thing also relates to what Sangharakshita sort of said a few times about actually becoming human first. You know, you need a human, you need to become fully human in order for suffering to actually be able to transform into something, to open a door, which is not, which is quite interesting, isn't it? It's a bit humbling when you look at yourself and you think sometimes you're not particularly human, you know, you're kind of in an animal realm or, like you say, all these different realms, hungry ghost, and it's not the realm that it's gonna happen in. It's quite interesting, isn't it? I mean, you could actually have those six realms in mind in your life, and then when you're suffering, you could actually just say, well, where, or not suffering, or maybe when you're just like, you know, totally blissed out, which realm am I in here? Anyway.
What was the second half of the...
So the second verse was, the virtue of suffering has no rival, since from the shock it causes, intoxication falls away, and there arises compassion for those in cyclic existence, fear of evil, and longing for the conqueror. So he says that, so there are four things that happen. first of all, intoxication falls away, which I think is a bit, it's probably related to the four reminders, or like really seeing that, I mean, that our life is not going to go on forever, and that we're going to die, and that we're going to age, and somehow that we all experience suffering, and that that is an existential kind of...
it's almost already an insight into suffering rather than suffering itself.
Yeah, right? It's that more like an
At least the awareness of suffering rather than...
I mean, he's...
Just because you suffer, your intoxications don't fall away.
No,
but that's what already, I was saying. Yeah.
I mean, he's basically talking to people that are seriously practicing, isn't he?
Sure.
Yeah. He's not talking to just like any old Tom, Dick and Harry, like, oh yeah, if you suffer, intoxication will fall away. He's like, well, that's not true.
I mean, he's talking to people, of course, because that is one of the six perfections. And he says, okay, you should practice forbearance and patience. And that will always include suffering, because life in cyclic existence will include suffering. So
his advice, in a way, in suffering, though, is not like a metaphysical statement, is it? It's like he's talking to people. It's not saying suffering will lead to intoxication falling away, full stop. It's more like he's sort of talking to people that are already really immersed in the Dharma and looking to practice, and he's kind of...
Of course,
he's telling them about suffering from that level, in a way.
I guess you couldn't... Yeah, I think if you already have a certain degree of practice behind you, sometimes you can not be aware of the subtler kinds of suffering, maybe, or you sometimes can almost become sort of complacent or something, because you don't really... you say, oh, well, oh, sure, you know, well, I've meditated enough. I can indulge in this, that, or the other. You know, I'm aware enough, or, you know, I just do it a bit. Or, I don't know, I'm trying to get at something here. But maybe not even intoxications or distractions, but even lifestyles or something, or certain ways of being. Like, you always need to look out for the for the next suffering, so to speak, that you're putting onto yourself.
It sounds a negative way to put it, but I think you're 100% right. For me, I think personally, for me, one of my biggest life lessons, in a way, was just completely not seeing the necessity for conditions.
Like,
for seeing, you know, just you get used to a certain level of positivity. You don't even think about it. Well, that's exactly the thing. You don't even think about it. You've become someone else.
Yeah.
And that's you. And then you change all your conditions on that basis because you feel good now. And you're in a completely different conditions. And then within 6 months, you're not you anymore. You're someone else, and you're suffering a lot.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, wow. It was like, I've had that little light bulb moment before, you know, just like throwing myself in completely crazy conditions off the back of quite intensive practice. And then almost being shocked, like, oh my God, I'm in a terrible state of mind, and I'm deeply unhappy, and that's not shifting. And it's like, well, look around you. The people are different. The whole place is different. it's conditionality. It's like the whole of Buddhism, isn't it? Like, things arise on conditions, and if the conditions aren't there for your happiness, don't just assume you've got insight. Like, you're just some enlightened character that's, oh yeah, I'm super enlightened now. That's probably the worst assumption you could make, you know. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, we do make progress, but to just assume that you're quote-unquote wise and compassionate, it's not a good idea.
Do you know what I mean? And I think also there's a danger to kind of, if you see conditions and you, of course, you actively can change that. I sometimes also catch myself that I kind of try to fix samsara in a way, because you feel like, oh, it would just require this make it better and more pleasant, or then it would work. But of course, I mean, this is a false view, because you think you can fix samsara, but you can't, because, I mean, there's just suffering.
But we do. I mean, whether you believe, I mean, we're all bought into that. I believe I can fix samsara, otherwise I wouldn't have an iPhone, iPad, X amount of stuff. You know, there's a certain view that you can fix this thing.
Make it a bit better. Yeah.
We're mixed beings, aren't we? Like, sometimes it's really obvious you can't. And then sometimes you just think, well, if I live a kind of fairly okay middle class lifestyle, that's sort of fixed, isn't it? Samsara is fixed a bit, and it's not what Buddhism is saying. Not saying that we should throw all our stuff away.
No, but I think sometimes it's also like, okay, you're in unpleasant situations with difficult conversations, and then, I mean, I notice that sometimes I can have the idea of, oh, okay, if only I don't know, the group of people would be different, or if like, I mean, this is then everything would be fine and we could really practice or whatever, but I mean, this is just, I mean, it's just samsara, so it's easier to acknowledge that
that's a really interesting topic, line, though, isn't it? Because between changing your conditions that do need changing in order to free you up and kind of create something into your experience that is actually going to take you into a more transcendent realm, and actually just fiddling with things and just complaining. It's like there is a there's a fine balance, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think here, I mean, I definitely think it's really important to change conditions in order to kind of live a Dharma life.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I guess because he's also, Shantideva is also talking to people who are on that path, and then kind of reminding them that still suffering is happening, patience is needed, it's not all going to be fine and easy.
So what was it? So intoxications fall away.
So that is the first one. Then compassions for those in cyclic existence arises.
Turning towards suffering, obviously, compassion would arise,
I mean, if you can really see suffering in your own experience, and I think, I mean, that's a lot what all the bodhicitta training is about, like to kind of really kind of be open for the suffering in this world in order to kind of respond with compassion. So, and I mean, I do feel like it's true that if I can resonate with somebody suffering because I can get an emotional sense of how it might feel to be in their shoes, somehow it's easier to kind of respond with compassion and not just with aversion or whatever, like, oh, I don't, even if it's a painful kind of situation.
Because I think ideally through Buddhist practice, I mean, we do the development of loving kindness meditations. Sometimes you think that, or sometimes people say, oh, I can't, you know, I'm a bit too thin, or I can't sort of let, you know, all these emotions to me, because you're trying to, you know, imagine all sorts of people. But I think ideally through Buddhist practice, you become bigger as a person, and you're actually more and more capable of facing suffering, I think. I mean, it's a long game, but both kind of loving kindness, but also then wisdom inside. Well, you know, what do you expect? There's, you know, happiness is scarce. You know, like, to reflect on that, actually, I think it makes your heart grow bigger, so you can actually face more and more varieties of suffering.
I was thinking, isn't it? It's interesting, though, you're saying about those, like the Brahmaviharas, they're called, those four practices, and you know, like the contemplation of, or the awareness of suffering is one of them. And I do find sometimes it's easy, temperamentally it's been easier for me to plug into that somehow, you know, slightly melancholic, and which is fine, you know. But then there's also that sometimes I think what myself and other people actually can find more challenging is like mudita, isn't it? It's like someone's experiencing joy in just a straightforward, I don't even like using this word worldly, but in a straight, just in a straightforward sense, yeah, they're having a nice ice cream or they're having a good day, and to actually really rejoice in that as well, to be like, oh, right, that's part of life as well, do you know what I mean? To really see that. That's, I think some ways for quote unquote religious people, that's more difficult. You know, it's much easier to just get into the kind of mournful, sorrowful kind of religiosity rather than actually seeing people that are just genuinely happy. It's like, I haven't done anything to earn it in a way. They're just having a nice ice cream. Maybe they have, and the sun's out, and you know, to look at them and not just feel like, oh, well, you'll suffer. You've eaten the ice cream now, but the suffering's coming, you know. And actually just to look and think, oh, this is really happy. This person's really happy. I find that more challenging sometimes, frankly.
It's interesting because I've been on a Brahma Vihara retreat a couple of years back, and it was interesting to notice that actually emotionally people were much more disturbed when doing the mudita practice. People started crying. It was really interesting to kind of see how much what you described. I mean, I think it was really kind of apparent then. And a while ago read, and I thought it's interesting that Nalayo, a Buddhist monk who teaches also a lot of Brahma Viharas, he said, it's interesting because compassion, like and the Karuna practice, is like just seeing the suffering in somebody else. It would more be like a reflection on suffering. So this is not like seeing the suffering and kind of also contemplating the suffering as suffering is not compassion. So compassion would really be to kind of wish them that they find relief and that they would get the means in order to kind of relieve the suffering. So I thought that it's kind of, it's really interesting to kind of distinguish the two things, that of course you need to kind of contemplate suffering somehow and recognize suffering for what it is. That, but that is the first step, and then it really requires a kind of positive outreaching attitude in order to kind of wish people that their suffering may end. So
it's like it's like a power. It feels almost like a magic power that sometimes, you know, when you can pull it off. I don't know how you do it, but like either just intentionally with a mantra or however you do it, where you can kind of do that. It feels like you're a wizard or something. You've got some kind of, you know what I mean? Like you've not just seen something, but you're actually able to put a charge into the atmosphere. Oh, it feels amazing. It's really something. It really does feel like a power somehow. And you can't force it, and you can't do it around being a wizard. But it's something to it. It's got a magical kind of quality. Like you say, it's not just reflective. It's not just a sense of wisdom and like, all right, this is the way the world is. There's a kind of other side to it, isn't it? Which is probably partially to do this whole thing of why, you know, in terms of the inspiration behind it, like the aliveness and the... it's got kind of got a living force to it that you can actually develop and engage in. It's really exhilarating, actually. It's like a secret thing. You kind of know you're doing it, or someone else knows they're doing it. You can feel it from them, and or they can feel it from you. And you say, "Ah, this is really interesting." No one's saying anything about it. You can't talk about it really, but even though we're talking,
and
about
normal people wouldn't know. I mean, it's a real secret.
What's the top? What time are we on?
Should wrap up soon.
Great.
Just the last bit was then longing for the conqueror. I love that. What was it?
I mean, it's fear of evil, which is actually, of course, I mean, that's the third one. Is of course like ethical behavior in a sense. You really kind of notice that you need to kind of behave ethically in order not to suffer. I mean,
good
because
to fear
you see,
evil.
Because you see that you will, it will kind of create suffering for yourself. So. I guess that's emotionally quite effective. And of course, and then the longing for the conqueror, which is Shraddha, or which is
longing for the conqueror.
It is real.
So it's the person, yeah? It's the conqueror, the person.
The
yeah?
conqueror. Yeah. I mean, the conqueror is probably the Buddha.
Yeah, the Buddha, obviously the enlightened one.
Mm. The enlightened one. So it's longing. Mm. It's in terms of shraddha development.
Mm. Yeah. It's interesting. I was just struck by the fact that you're longing for the conqueror and not longing for enlightenment or...
Mm.
Mm.
Well, it's the same, but yeah. but as a personalized mm. thing mm. rather than you longing yourself to become the conqueror.
Well, that's actually yeah. in a funny way what you just said. In a way, that's the kind of key to Buddhism. Just key to Buddhism. You notice it when people get it. Yeah. It becomes personal. It's not just an idea. You don't just who's longing for enlightenment? No one. Mm. No one's walking around longing for enlightenment. It's like it's like you actually, because in a way that it sounds almost selfish. Like
yeah.
But you do, when you notice that yourself, you know, there's a moment, isn't it, where you kind of, it becomes personal.
Yeah.
It's like, and then something's changed. And it's, I normally notice it, I've noticed it myself and others in a way, it's sometimes I do the pujas as well, like pujas, mantras, rituals, there's a certain click that you may have had all the study groups in the world and blah, 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 but there's a certain thing that goes in. You know, right, some people are starting to, mm-hmm. there's something personal there, mm. an atmosphere to it.
Mm.
Yeah. Just longing for
the conqueror.
Other shore,
for the Buddha to smile, mm-hmm. to like with Sunita.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Smile at you, and what was it? I just read the last thing.
Yeah. Mm, that was Sunita. Nice that the Buddha smiled mm. at him.
Yeah. So we left off with the ordination. So I'm just going to read the last mm. verses after the mm. ordination. Staying alone in the wilderness, meditating tirelessly. I have completed what the teacher taught, just as the victor advised me. In the first watch of the night, I recollected my past lives. In the middle watch of the night, I purified my clairvoyance. In the last watch of the night, I shattered the mass of darkness. At the end of the night, as the sunrise drew near, Indra and Brahma came and revered me with joined hands. Homage to you, O thoroughbred, homage to you, supreme among men. Since your defilements are ended, you, sir, are worthy of a religious donation. When he saw me honored by the assembly of gods, the teacher smiled and said the following: by austerity and spiritual practice, by restraint and by taming, that's how to become a Brahmin. This is the supreme Brahmin.
Well, maybe that's a good place to leave
it. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you next time.
Yeah.
Great.
Bye-bye.
Great. Bye-bye.
Ciao.